Justice Miller Lerman is rejoining the court. Mr. Lopez, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Although the court has twice now rejected Mr. Webb's motion to dismiss, I'd like to address the jurisdictional issue first. But unless the court prefers otherwise, I'd like to do so briefly. Mr. Webb's entire jurisdictional argument for why our appeal was untimely rests on the proposition that this was primarily a 1983 action instead of some state law action, and thus the court's Gilpatrick decision from last year would control, such that the application for fees was a collateral matter, which, though undecided and pending at the time the district court issued its decision, didn't start the time for appeal, or did start the time for appeal. Simply put, my friend has, I think, very accurately articulated what the Gilpatrick rule is, but they are misapplying it. This is not primarily a 1983 action. In fact, for all of the other reasons we've set out in the brief, not only could it not be, is it not, it could never be, since, in our view, a combination of a 1983 and an APA judicial review proceeding is impermissible.
Do you need the district court's order on the merits of the 1983 claim to be appealable to get the relief you're seeking in this appeal? There's, as I understand, there's an appeal taken from an order awarding fees.
Yes.
And I don't think there's any disagreement that that order is appealable.
Is that sufficient? I don't think so. Justice Papik, I don't think there's a dispute that that would be appealable. And let me illustrate that and bring it home in a different sense. Let's say the 1983 claim had never been added onto the APA petition. And let's say the district court had found that our position on the state law claim was not substantially justified. Then under 251803, they would have a fee entitlement under the state law action. It would work the same way, and we would appeal from that order granting us fees under 1803. If I've adequately answered your question. Our position, though, is that regardless of how the fee award was dressed up, it should have never been viewed as being primarily a 1983 action. So Gilpatrick doesn't...
Didn't the court deny the state law action for attorney's fees?
Yes.
In its first order?
Yes.
Okay, was that appealed?
No, but I don't think that matters. I don't think it matters because they were never allowed, in our view, based on our merits argument, to combine the 1983 claim with the petition, with the APA petition anyway. And I think this court's rule should follow what the type of the action actually is, rather than what the applicant for fees, and in this case the district court, thinks it is.
Really what you're arguing is the 1983 action should not have been commingled with the APA action.
Absolutely.
And to decide that, we would have to decide, you've appealed the 1988 attorney's fees request.
Well,
is that right?
Yes.
And that's the appeal, that's the order that you appeal from timely.
Procedurally, right? Yes. But again, I think the appeal timing would have to, since we're in, our argument is that since it's not primarily a 1983 action, and you couldn't have a 1983 action anyway, this court's older cases, Kilgore, Murray, Olson, would all control when our appeal timing, when we needed to appeal. And
if it was a state law action, attorney's fees.
Yes.
But that's not the case here, because the court decided that in the first order.
Correct. But even under our alternative argument, even if Gilpatrick does control, and if you were to look at our having appealed from the 1988 fee award as being, okay, the state appealed from the 1988 award, they have to live or die on whether Gilpatrick controls, we still are safe from a jurisdictional standpoint, I would argue, for the alternative reason we put in our reply brief, which is even under the Hulluck-Gravel case from the U.S. Supreme Court, there is adequate procedure in place and flexibility for a district court to say, okay, I'm going to hold this order non-final. We have a pending fee application, whether it came in under state law or federal law. We have a pending fee application. It has not been decided on. This is a prevailing party. I'm going to give the parties time to determine that.
Is that antithetical to the federal statutory structure?
Not at all. In fact, it's something that happens on a fairly regular basis, and we provided a citation in our brief to the Burnback case from the federal district court, where the court effectively did the same thing. It said, okay, we have a prevailing party, the merits have been decided, but it doesn't make any sense for, well, they didn't say all this, but the underlying principle is, it doesn't make any sense to bifurcate into piecemeal appeals, the merits issue and then the fees issue. In the federal system, there, and this is quoted from the Hallett Gravel case in our reply brief, but there's a series of federal rules motions that you would need to make in order to trigger that tolling.
Is there Nebraska state law analogs to those?
Not specifically, no, but it's something that we're already accustomed to that under the old state law rules. So I don't think it's at all.
Are you arguing that you have multiple opportunities to appeal here?
No, I don't think we could have appealed from the initial, I don't think we could have appealed from the initial order, since our argument is that the 1983 claim should have never been part of the APA review in the first place. And in that circumstance, this court's older decisions, Kilgore, Murray, Olson, indicating when the time to appeal begins.
Did you contest that?
Contest what?
The commingling of the...
Yes.
You did.
Yes.
That was the basis of the motion to dismiss?
That's absolutely right.
And why a motion to dismiss the 1983 action instead of a motion to sever?
I can't speak to why it wasn't a motion to sever. From the motion to dismiss standpoint, I don't, and it's, this runs into some, it up against some of the problems with combining the two actions, because civil action rules shouldn't necessarily control over an APA review petition where the court is sitting as an appellate court. It has, you know, the APA statutes governing how the district court functions in that circumstance look more like this court's appellate rules than the civil procedure rules in Chapter 25. But the best mechanism to challenge that would be a Rule 12 motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. So,
What's your best argument for why these shouldn't be combined?
Kozel and Betterman, given that Kozel says that if you try to do something or bring your case in contravention with the requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act, then you have not properly invoked the court's jurisdiction, and there's no jurisdiction for whatever procedural move you're trying to make. In this case, Mr. Webb, and this brings me to my merits argument, in this case, Mr. Webb invoked the district court's procedure on the basis that he was seeking review of an administrative agency decision under the APA's judicial review statute.
Wasn't there two causes of action in his filing?
Yes, and my argument is that he should not have been permitted to have the 1983 piece.
You agree he has the right to bring the 1983 action?
Yes.
He has the right to bring the APA review?
Yes.
Just can't do them together?
I don't think so.
What authority? Any statutory authority to that?
Well, in fact, I'm arguing against direct contrary authority because I'm asking
Maldonado.
You to overrule Maldonado.
Right.
Maldonado rests on a false premise, I believe. Saying it assumes that the Supreme Court had decided that for purposes of state administrative law, it was settled for all time that you could combine a freestanding 1983 claim with an APA, a state law administrative review claim.
Any statutory authority to support that argument?
The entire APA. The record limitation, the limitation on parties, what the court is allowed to do in terms of the scope of its review, all of it. We've outlined in our brief. I'd like to save my last 30 seconds if I could.
Thank you very much. Mr. McEwen, good morning to you.
Good
You may proceed.
My name is Robert E. Ewan, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Azar Webb, in this case. And as the appellant noted, we're here today to discuss whether this court should overrule its prior decision in Maldonado. As noted in our brief, stare decisis forms the bedrock of this court's jurisprudence. It should not be overturned unless it is clearly erroneous or the reasons cease to exist.
What was the rationale for this court's holding in Maldonado?
Rationale for this court's holding in Maldonado was based on a U.S. Supreme Court decision which determined that it was possible, but not mandatory, for state administrative proceedings to count for purposes of Section 1988 fees. And the appellee contends that the appellant mischaracterized the one sentence plucked from that opinion, focused on the word held instead of the word may in that United States, or in the Nebraska Supreme Court decision in Maldonado. But the real issue at Maldonado is not the language of the APA. It is not the language raised by the appellant. In fact, absent from the appellant's brief is the plain and unambiguous language that we should be focusing on, Section 1988. And in that language...
Let me kind of repeat, in effect, the same question I was asking. What is 1988 inextricably linked to an outcome in 1983?
If you're a prevailing party, yes. It's inextricably linked, Your Honor.
Would you have had to plead a 1983 action to seek attorney's fees in a 1988 relief?
No, Your Honor. But we did so in this case, maybe too forthrightly. We wanted everybody to be on the same page from the beginning of this case, raising the federal statutes at action. We made no hiding the ball efforts here. We wanted everyone to know what we were doing from this case. And under Maldonado, the Burnside plaintiffs in that case didn't ever plead 1983. They didn't even list it. So we felt we did more than we even had to in this matter. Going back briefly to Justice Papik's first question, I believe the answer to your question is they need the May 10th order in this case, and that's why they appealed it. What they're trying to do here is different from questioning the reasonableness of attorney's fees. They're trying to undertack the entire premise of this case by saying we shouldn't have been able to bring it.
But isn't the state's position that there's no jurisdiction to decide there's no subject matter jurisdiction for a district court to consider a 1983 claim in the context of an APA appeal? Would you agree with me that far?
That is their contention.
And if that's the case, wouldn't there be no subject matter jurisdiction to enter a fee award at the conclusion of the case? And I understand you disagree with their position on the merits, but assume they're right that there is no subject matter jurisdiction. Wouldn't that also be sufficient to invalidate the fee award at the end of the case?
Yes, as long as they appealed from the May 10th order, Your Honor. In a timely manner, which they did not do in this case.
But why do they have to appeal from the May 10th order?
The appeal from the May 10th order is commanded by this court's precedent, Gilpatrick. And in that case, what we have here, my distinguished colleague, on behalf of the Office of the Nebraska Attorney General, last year successfully appealed a motion for summary judgment in a 1983 case that they had lost at the district court level. They appealed before attorney's fees were raised, and it appears that they're attempting to argue now that the Gilpatrick case does not govern because this action is not primarily a Section 1988 case. We contend this has been a viable route established by this court since the mid-1980s. We raised this from the beginning of our case. This is a 1983 case in the truest sense possible. What we have here is an APA case that was raised at the APA hearing level. The only questions before the hearing officer were whether or not they had violated our client's civil rights, which they're not challenging here. And then the only question in the same ball of facts and law in the district court, in both the APA claim and the 1983 claim, is whether or not they violated our client's federal civil rights. It's a 1983 case in the truest sense possible. It's been viable in this state since the mid-1980s.
Why is it important to you to be able to bring these actions together?
For our clients specifically, and getting back to the earlier McEwen case and a discussion of sovereign immunity, it's important to our client. Our client is a young man who incurred significant medical debt because of the violation of his federal rights. And the APA is a waiver of sovereign immunity, which entitles him to receive retroactive monetary reimbursements for the entire time that this case was going on, for the medical debt that he continued to accrue by the defendants or the appellant's ongoing violation of federal law. So it's important for us to be able to bring these types of cases because that's what benefits our clients the most. And that goes to one of the arguments that we have in our brief about a devil's choice or strategic machinations the council are going to be forced to make if we are not able to do or bring these actions together. And then also regarding the appeal timeline, in light of Gilpatrick, I'm not certain what the end result would be. When would the order be a final, essentially? What happens if you revoke your request for attorney's fees after that May 10th order on the 31st day? Or you never file for attorney's fees? The actions of counsel should not determine when something becomes final. The substance of the legal issues should determine when something becomes final and appealable. The appellant...
But in other contexts, that's exactly what can happen if you have, disregarding the APA for a moment, you have a multiple claim petition and you have a decision on some of the claims, but it's not appealable under 25-13-15, and someone dismisses with prejudice the remaining claim, they have accelerated the appeal time, haven't they?
Indeed, Your Honor, they have.
This is not a principle unknown within our law.
Within our law, that is correct, Your Honor, but that principle is contrary to the underlying purpose of Section 1988. It disincentivizes or does not incentivize the attorneys to represent individuals with financial barriers raising their important federal issues. Essentially, attorneys shouldn't have to choose whether or not they seek fees in a case where their client has their federal civil rights enforced. And turning momentarily to the merits issue in this case, again, we contend that Maldonado was correctly decided by this court. The plain and unambiguous language of Section 1988 has three elements. First, whether the district court's review of an APA proceeding constitutes any action or proceeding. Second, whether the action was to enforce a provision of Section 1983. Third, whether the district court in our state is a court. The argument from the appellant and their corresponding briefs do not address this language, as I mentioned earlier, but they also begin their analysis of the Nebraska APA from an incorrect frame of reference. So as noted in our brief, the appellant frames their analysis of the district court's authority here from the perspective that the APA is narrowly circumscribing what the district court is able to do. Essentially because the legislature has not specifically granted the district court authority to award fees in Section 1988 in the context of the APA, it's not allowed to do so. However, the district court in our state is a court of general jurisdiction, and that's what the legislature chose to award the review of these cases to.
I think the state has conceded that a 1983 claim could be heard in the district court. The question is whether it can be joined together with an APA appeal. Is there any authority you can point to, statutory or otherwise, outside of Maldonado, which you talked about, that indicates that those can be joined to, that the 1983 claim can be added to the administrative appeal?
Yes, Your Honor. The Wimley case cited by the appellants in the brief collects the successful cases where this has been done across the country, in addition to the cases where it has not been done.
Any Nebraska statutes?
No. Again, the appellee would contend that Nebraska statutes are not the statute that we need to be analyzing here in Section 19. There are no Nebraska statutes specifically authorizing this type of action. What we have here and in Maldonado, again, these are very similar cases in that the Nebraska issues and the 1983 issues all are related to the same ball of facts. No additional evidence was used by the district court in their proceeding. They used all of the underlying evidence from the administrative hearing to make both the APA decision and the 1983 decision. The only difference here is that we pled it specifically and put everybody on notice. And then I would just like to point to And again, this may be tangentially answers your question, Your Honor, but we believe that the APA is broad enough in and of itself, and was broadened in 1989 to include reviews of federal law issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 29 seconds, Mr. Lopez.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'll be very brief. I'm going to, if I could, lean on my reply brief for all of the jurisdictional arguments, which express my friend's points. I'd like to conclude on just the practical reasons why the APA doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to allow 1983 APA combinations. We're locked into a record from the agency. That record might have been brought in without the rules of evidence if nobody invoked them. That means we could be potentially defending against a springing 1983 claim upon the district court, locked into the record that was brought into the agency. With that, I would ask that you vacate the district court's order and directions to dismiss the 1983 action.
Thank you very much.